TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. What makes our lights go on? The epic struggle over dams, displaced people, and the environment. A battle is being fought by independent scientists and those employed by the hydropower industry over the discovery that reservoirs behind the world's dams are a source of global warming pollution. In the case of big reservoirs in the tropics, where most new dams are proposed, hydropower can actually emit more greenhouse gases per kilowatt hour than fossil fuels, including dirty coal. The worst example studied by an independent scientist is the Balbina Dam in the Brazilian Amazon. The dam had a climate impact in 1990 equal to an astonishing 54 natural gas plants, generating the same amount of power. The issue of hydropower is important to all, as we are searching for the best replacement for fossil-fueled energy. Patrick McCauley is the author of Silenced Rivers, The Ecology and Politics of Large Dams. He's a member of the steering committee of the United Nations Environment Program's Dams and Development Project and the executive director of the International Rivers Network. I interviewed him right after his return from the November 2006 United Nations negotiations on global climate in Nairobi. Here is Patrick McCauley.
The global warming impact of dams is definitely one of the least known impacts of dams upon the global systems. The general message that the dam industry puts out is that hydropower is clean and renewable and climate friendly, and that compared to dirty coal or other fossil fuels, this is a much better way of generating our energy. But actually, there's a number of reasons for opposing this depiction of hydropower, and global warming is just one of them. The impacts, the huge numbers of people that are displaced, you know, 40 to 60 million people worldwide have been displaced by dams, not just hydropower, but dams, but for all purposes. 60% or so of the world's rivers have been damaged to some extent by the impoundments of reservoirs and the changes in river flows that dams caused. You've seen huge loss of riverine species. Fish is the best known, but also all other types of life forms that live in rivers and life forms that even live in floodplains, sometimes quite far from the river, but they're impacted by the loss of the normal floods that dams cause. So there's a huge range of impacts, which means that dams are often a very dirty technology. There's also the issue of sedimentation. Dams fill with sediment over time. All rivers carry some amount of sediments, and almost all dams will eventually fill up with sediments and become nothing more than very expensive waterfalls. So from that respect, this is not a renewable energy the way, say, solar or wind power is. But on the global warming emission, in the tropics where most of the new dams are being built, the emissions of greenhouse gases, methane and carbon dioxide, also nitrous oxide, can be extremely high. And in many cases, it appears as high or in some cases even much higher than fossil fuel power.
That's a surprise to people that, after all these sacrifices of land and lives, that you don't even come up with a technology that's beneficial. You actually pointed to this issue in your book already. You have a little chapter. You were one of the first people to describe the greenhouse gas emissions of dams. Can you explain the science behind it?
Yeah, well, first, is that yes, it's not new that to discover that dams do emit greenhouse gases. It's been known since the mid-90s and quantified to some extent since the mid-90s, but it's been a very little-known branch of science, and there hasn't been very many scientists working on it, and most of the scientists who have been working on it are funded by the hydropower industry, so, of course, there's been an interest to really downplay the significance of the emissions. But over the years, there has been more studies have come out, and it has become clear just how serious the emissions are. And it still is a very complex issue, and there are a lot of uncertainties. But there's enough known now, anyway, to say that these emissions are very high. And how does it happen? Well, when you flood a large area of land in the tropics, you're flooding a lot of carbon. You flood all the forests, there's carbon in the soils, all the vegetation that was there before the reservoir. And when that rots, it gives off the gas, or creates the gas, carbon dioxide underwater, also creates methane, which is actually a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, around over 20 times more effective at trapping heat than carbon dioxide. Now, when the studies were first done on this issue, it was thought, okay, there are emissions from the flooding of the forest vegetation that was flooded, but after, say, 10 years when all that vegetation is flooded, then it will be clean, it will be climate friendly, there will be no more emissions. Turns out that's not the case. Now, studies have been done in reservoirs that are several decades old, and they find still very high emissions. And the reason for that is that not only do you have the carbon in the vegetation originally flooded, but also you have carbon which flows down the river. Every river carries carbon in various forms, mainly the organic matter, the leaves and different parts of vegetation that fall into the river, and carbon from the soils that's washed into the river as part of erosion. That all enters the reservoir, and then that provides the fuel to keep the greenhouse gas emissions going. You have also plants that grow in the reservoir. You have plankton and water weeds that grow on the surface of the reservoir. All the different life forms in the reservoir, they die, sink to the bottom, and provide more fuel for the emissions. You have plants that grow around the edge of the reservoir. So when the reservoir is lower during the dry season, you get a lot of, if it's a sort of a shallow type of reservoir in a largely flat area, you get a lot of plants go around the edge, and then the reservoir is filled again. Those plants are flooded, and then they rot and give off, especially methane is the one that's especially problematic. So basically, for the lifetime of the reservoir, it seems that you do have these emissions. And where you have a large reservoir and a not particularly high generating capacity, then you will have emissions that are at least on the same scale as fossil fuels, if not worse. And some of the cases in Brazil are quite stunning. One of the dams in the central Amazon called Balbina, which flooded a large, very flat area for a pretty small amount of electricity, its emissions are something like 54 times those of a gas plant, a modern, very efficient gas plant, which is shockingly high. It's about 30 times, almost 30 times that of a dirty coal plant. So these can be incredibly high emissions. I'm saying that, of course, you can get a hydropower plant in a canyon, a very narrow canyon, doesn't flood a lot of vegetation, and has a high generating capacity. And there the emissions won't be significant and won't be anything like a fossil fuel plant. But basically, like the Amazon, most of the reservoirs are actually in rather flat land, so they do have very high emissions.
I guess people are really beginning to see that these reservoirs are not like normal lakes. They have sort of a curious...
There's a number of reasons why they're not like lakes. Now, one thing important to remember is that lakes themselves are quite high emitters of methane and carbon dioxide, so that the average emissions for each square meter of lake is much higher than the average emissions from each square meter of land. So even if a reservoir was just like a lake, you still would increase greenhouse gas emissions. But for a number of reasons, reservoirs are different. And one thing that happens with hydropower is that you have a dam, and obviously water exits the dam. It either goes through the turbines to generate electricity, or certain times of the year when basically there's too much water for the turbines, it goes over through a spillway and travels downstream that way. Now, what happens is that with the reservoir water in the tropics, it's very rich in methane, and that methane is under pressure because, of course, the deeper you go in the water, the higher the pressure is on the methane. But then the water from some depth, the actual depth will vary according to the individual dam, the water at depth will be released through the turbines or through the spillway. The pressure is released, and then suddenly you have this huge fizz of methane and carbon dioxide bubbles, and it's analogous to opening a bottle of soda, a bottle of Coke, or whatever soft drink you like, and just like a bottle of Coke, you open it, or especially if you shake it, you get a more dramatic effect. The carbon dioxide fizzes up because the pressure is released, and that's just the same thing is happening at a dam. And those emissions at the dam itself can be very sizable. Now, when I first wrote about this issue back in 1995 or so, I was unaware, scientists were unaware of this impact, but in the last 10 years it's been increasingly studied, and it's been very controversial because if you include the what are called degassing emissions or operational emissions at the dam itself, you increase greatly, and in some cases you increase by several times your measurement of the overall climate impact of the dam. So the hydropower industry has been very emphatic in saying, no, these degassing emissions don't exist, or if they do exist, they're very small, and you can't just use, you know, mathematical models and do science to predict what these emissions are going to be. You can only count the emissions from the surface of the reservoir, but scientifically, it doesn't seem to have any basis to not count the degassing emissions, and I get the feeling the hydropower industry is realizing that actually they can't sort of hold out against this anymore, and they're going to have to include these emissions. Very recently, so since I came out with our latest report on this issue, there's been more studies showing that there's also degassing emissions downstream, so not all the methane is released at the dam itself. And the people who are modelling the emissions at the dam are not presuming that all is released. They're saying something like 60% of the methane is actually released at the dam. But now people have been studying the river downstream and saying a lot of that remaining 60% is released downstream. So when you include that, it means the impact of the reservoir is even higher.
Downstream, releases downstream. How does that happen?
So you have the very methane-rich water, which is expelled from the dam, and then a lot of the methane, say 60%, depending on the design of the spillway and other factors, is released at the dam itself, but it's still, the water is still very rich in methane when it exits the dam. So over the several kilometres, I think studies have been done for 10 kilometres downstream of the dam, you still have a lot of methane being emitted from the water, and something like a third as much methane, or up to a third as much methane from the river immediately downstream as from the whole surface of the reservoir itself. Petit Saut Dam in French Guiana, this was the first place where they measured the degassing emissions at the dam itself, and first time they realized how high these could be. The methane emissions at Petit Saut are huge. Overall, the average impact over the first 20 years of its operation, it's about five times higher than those from what a gas plant would be. Originally, when the dam was built, the emissions weren't so high, but then the water was very high levels of dissolved methane in it, and it was poisonous to all aquatic life. So for about 80 kilometres downstream, basically everything was killed. And so they then had to build a small dam immediately downstream of the main dam to create a little waterfall and then basically oxygenate the water. But in that process, they also gave off a lot more of the methane. So they enabled the river not to be totally toxic to life downstream, but then greatly increased the greenhouse gas emissions. In Brazil, there's been one rigorously independent scientist called Philip Fernside, who's an American but has spent 30 years in Brazil working in the Amazon, and he's one of the world's leading experts on the science of carbon dioxide fluxes, emissions, and sinks for carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the forests of the Amazon. So he has done a number of studies on reservoirs and showing that the emissions are very high. He's been vociferously, quite brutally, you could say, attacked by the hydropower lobby-funded scientists in Brazil. But just in the last year or two, sort of some more scientists are starting to look at this issue and really come to the defense of Philip Fernside and say, look, these attacks on him are ridiculous, and this is just basic science that he's doing. So the journal Climatic Change, which is a very respected journal on this issue the climate change issue in general, did an editorial written by two analysts from Stanford saying, you know, this is a ridiculous way to carry out scientific study, and that basically Fernside appears to be right in what he's saying. His assumptions all make sense, and that this issue has become too politicized to really to get some serious science out of it, so we need some independent review to sort of neutralize the power of the hydro lobby in the science, and that's what we've been pushing for in terms of trying to get the United Nations to get their scientific bodies that work on climate change to look at this issue, and the results are going to be that it will become generally accepted that the tropical hydropower emissions can be very high.
You know, seen in the context of the enormously rising carbon dioxide emissions, we do need to come up with an explanation, an honest explanation, where it all comes from. Not just from the tailpipes of automobiles or industrial emissions.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the many reasons why climate change is so incredibly difficult for us to get a grip with and to really try to reduce is there are so many different sources of the off greenhouse gases. The ones from tailpipes of cars and smokestacks of power plants are the most obvious ones, but there's also huge emissions which come just from land change, from farmers ploughing fields, and the type of ploughing method you use will affect how much carbon you release. There's huge releases from natural ecosystems, which are very poorly understood, wetlands and different types of forests. There's different gases we're talking about. There's carbon dioxide is the best known, and then there's methane, and then there's nitrous oxide, which is released in much smaller quantities than the other gases, but it's very powerful, 200 times more than carbon dioxide, more or less. And then you have some industrial gases, the HFC, HCFC gases, for example. These were all alternatives to the infamous CFCs, which are destroying the ozone layer. But unfortunately, these CFC alternatives are themselves very powerful greenhouse gases, some of them almost 12,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So to deal with this problem, we need to know all the very many different sources of the gases and then work out what's the best way of controlling them all, and try to work out also, you know, which is the most cost-effective way to go and which ones can we start to reduce the quickest. I mean, it's very easy to measure, relatively easy to measure the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we've been doing it since the 50s. And every year you can get a very accurate scientific, I mean, any day you can get a very accurate scientific measurement of what that concentration is, but it's much more difficult to actually work out where is all that carbon dioxide coming from. And the figures that are available show that I would say maybe something like 10% of all the global methane emissions could be coming from reservoirs. Some people say it's much higher. If we were to include reservoirs in global inventories of methane emissions, and currently they're not included at all, that it would almost double our estimates of methane emissions. But whatever it is a very sizable component of the total emissions, and something that we need to, at the very least, we need to stop increasing this area of large reservoirs and stop making this problem worse.
Yeah, listening to you, it seems that even if a dam were to be retired as electricity producing, just sitting there, a dam and a reservoir, would still have climate impacts.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. What does happen towards the end of a dam's life if it becomes too filled up with sediment to generate power anymore and it's, you know, turned off, which has happened to quite a few dams around the world? If the dam is kept in place, then you will have a big wetland behind the dam, and it is likely to have very high greenhouse gas emissions, pretty much in perpetuity. Now, you do have the issue that you could decommission the dam, and increasingly this is becoming seen as a viable option, actually removing the dam. Problem is, for the very big projects, that would be hugely expensive, and the way hydropower plant financing currently works, no money is set aside for the eventual decommissioning of the plant. There should be a certain percentage of money each year the dam generates electricity, a certain percentage of money should be put aside so to allow for eventual decommissioning. It's not done. So a lot of countries are going to end up in 50, 100 years' time with huge numbers of dams that they built all over their rivers, and they're going to be filled with sediment. They're not going to be very much use. They're going to start where they're going to be very dangerous and pose threats to people living downstream, and there's not going to be any money to remove them. So this is a future threat we face.
Talk a little bit more about the simple scale of these projects that you described so beautifully in your book.
Well, hydropower projects, dam projects in general, are some of the biggest constructions that human beings create, and the dams themselves are some of the largest pieces of physical infrastructure that we've ever built, and reservoirs are, as human artifacts, are on the scale of our largest cities. People talk about the Great Wall of China as being the only human artifact you can see from space. I've actually heard that's not true. You can't see it, but you can see reservoirs from space. If you look at a map of the world, you'll see quite a lot of reservoirs around the world that show up even on the scale of a map. For some countries, large percentages of their total area are flooded under reservoirs. For Ghana in West Africa, that has the world's largest reservoir, 5% of the area of the country is flooded by one reservoir. Globally, the area of reservoirs is, there's various estimates, range between 260,000 square kilometers up to 1.5 million square kilometers, a huge range there. This is on the scale of the state of California, that I think is around 400,000 square kilometers. So you're talking something like the entire land area of California being flooded by reservoirs worldwide, which is a huge loss of land. It's something like around between 0.5 to 1% of the world's the sort of terrestrial surface of the Earth that is flooded. But it's important to remember that what we're talking about is not just any 1% of the Earth's surface. This is river valley land. This is some of the best land we have in terms of agriculturally productive land, in terms of biologically productive wetlands and riverside forests and so on. So we're losing some of the most diverse and most productive land that we have.
The shocking thing is that the hydropower generated often does not go to the people around it or the displaced people. It goes directly into a smelter.
Yeah, it goes to aluminum smelters, or it goes to the cities, or it goes to mines. No, you see it, especially places like Africa, sometimes the most shocking, where you have some of the world's biggest hydro plants, and yet you have very low rates of people with access to electricity. You know, Uganda, where we've been doing a lot of work recently, 95% of the population doesn't have access to electricity. I mean, I've been to villages that have been displaced by dams, and the power lines almost literally go right overhead. I mean, you see the power lines just, you know, over the next hillside, and the village, meanwhile, has no electricity, and, you know, probably will never get electricity, or at least will never get electricity from the dam. Maybe they will be able to have some small-scale solar panels or something, but even a micro-hydro that might provide village-level benefits. But these big projects, the power lines, they go off to the cities.
Some people will claim that the hydro projects also opened up lands for irrigation that were previously not used.
They do. Reservoirs have opened up a lot of land for irrigation, but there's a number of problems with this. One thing is the belief that land that wasn't irrigated before was not used, and very often you have land which actually is used by people but not using irrigation, or sometimes they are using irrigation but maybe irrigating crops once a year as opposed to twice a year. But very often what we see is that you have small-scale farmers using lands which are then taken over by large commercial agribusiness when the water comes in. You can see the impact of this in California, where huge amounts of land have been irrigated through the Central Valley of California, through the big dam and canal schemes, the big aqueducts we've built. And you look at the counties in California with the very lowest social indicators in terms of, I mean, highest poverty levels, lowest income levels and so on, you see those are the counties which get the most irrigation water, because irrigation water tends to mean big, very capital-intensive farms where laborers are working for very low wages, and you don't have basically small family farms don't survive in those areas. And the same thing happens in the rest of the world, but the additional problem in many places is that these big schemes are incredibly poorly managed, and you have lots of leaks of water from the canals, and you have a lot of water logging and salinization of the land, and you also have very poor yields. So you see yields on land which is irrigated from groundwater, from wells, is often 2 to 3 times higher than the yields from the big dam and canal schemes. And you hear a lot of arguments made by the dam industry now that, you know, with this growing population, we need to feed the growing population, therefore we're going to need to build lots more of these big dam and canal projects and irrigate more land. But you actually look at the world and where the places are we have left to build these projects, there's very few. To build a big dam and canal project, you need a large expanse of flat land near a major river, and most of those places are now exploited. And take California, for example. Central Valley in California is pretty much fully exploited now. There's nowhere for agriculture to expand. In fact, agriculture is retreating because of suburban sprawl. And it's the same whether you look in India and Africa, South America. There's very few large areas left for this type of irrigation. On the other hand, there's huge parts of the world, rural parts of the world which have been starved of any type of government investment, because all the investment has been thrown into these big irrigation schemes. And if you are serious about wanting to reduce poverty worldwide, if you're serious about wanting to increase food production, serious about trying to meet these United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which are all about reducing poverty and improving the lives of the poorest people, that's only going to be done through a program of small-scale water infrastructure, small dams and rainwater harvesting schemes, and better use of groundwater and small technologies like treadle human-operated pumps, and technologies which are cheap and small-scale, can be used locally, don't depend on billions of dollars of foreign capital coming in and building huge schemes, which are then going to grow crops, which are largely for export anyway and don't feed local people. So if we had a very different model of agricultural and water development, we could make really huge strides in dealing with the worst problems of poverty in the world. If we continue in this model of pouring all our money into these big projects, we're going to see very little returns out of it.
You heard an interview with the executive director of the International Rivers Network. Patrick McCauley is the author of the acclaimed book, Silenced Rivers, The Ecology and Politics of Large Dams. The International Rivers Network, on the web as irn.org, protects rivers and defends the rights of communities that depend on them. IRN opposes destructive dams and the development model they advance. They encourage better ways of meeting people's needs for water, energy, and protection from floods. In November 2006, the International Rivers Network released a major report urging the United Nations to take steps to include the impact of dams and reservoirs on global warming. You can download the report from IRN's website, www.irn.org, or visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. For links in this story and more information. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape of Dams and Global Warming with Patrick McCauley and last week's talk by Jacques Leslie. This program is also available as film on DVD. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD, tape, or DVD order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape, CD, or film on DVD by mail or credit card by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.